regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
Government regulations, which were created to protect
the regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Colton Grob. I'm the Deputy Director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. This afternoon, we're pleased to host a conversation exploring how governments and private companies are utilizing surveillance programs to combat the spread of COVID-19 and the potential implications of this increased data collection going forward. Before we get started, I'll note that after opening remarks and discussion between our panelists, we will go to audience Q&A, so please be thinking of the questions you'd like to ask our speakers. I'll now hand it off to Neil Chilson, who is a Senior Research Fellow for Technology and Innovation at the Charles Koch Institute. He'll kick off today's conversation. Neil, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Colton. And it's great to be back here with the FedSec RTP podcast and to talk about this really important topic. As COVID-19 spreads across the planet, we've faced a pretty difficult and deadly trial. And here in the U.S., the best evidence available is that more than 2 million people have contracted COVID-19 and more than 100,000 deaths have been attributed to it. And so to fight COVID-19, nations across the world have explored a lot of different methods to track the virus. Some, such as Singapore and South Korea, have established these national comprehensive surveillance networks. Others, like the U.S., have delegated a lot of the responsibility to the states, and this has resulted in a lot of different types of approaches. Private companies like Google and Apple have also stepped in to assist this effort. Data on how the virus spreads appears crucial to public health efforts, but there are serious concerns that such widespread data collection activities may be overly intrusive and that privacy interests have not been adequately considered. And some question the security of these various efforts, especially as hackers and cyber criminals turn their attention towards these new surveillance programs. So we have with that introduction, we have a great panel with us today to discuss the topic. I will introduce them. I will give some brief remarks on my thoughts on this topic generally, and then our two other panelists will give their remarks, and then we'll do some back and forth, and then finally we'll open it to audience Q&A, so get those questions ready. So first up will be Roger D. Klein. He is a faculty fellow at the Center for Law, Science, and Innovation at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He's also the chief medical officer of OmniSec, and he has his own consulting firm. He has an MD and a JD from Yale, and he is an expert on the regulatory impacts of regulation on health and public health. Also with us is Drew Bagley. He is Vice President and Counsel for Privacy and Cyber Policy at CrowdStrike, which is a major cybersecurity technology company. At CrowdStrike, he is responsible for leading CrowdStrike's data protection initiatives, privacy strategy, and global policy engagement, which means he has to pay attention to a lot of things going on around the world, and COVID is certainly a hot topic that impacts cybersecurity, so we're glad to have him as well. So before turning it over to Roger, I thought I'd just touch on three topics that I think are sort of foundational for this conversation. In my brief introduction, I mentioned that governments are using location data to combat COVID-19, and they're doing so in two ways. First, they're using it for what's called contact tracing, which is a way to identify all the people a sick person has encountered. This is helpful in addressing the spread of a virus because once you know who the person has contacted, you can help, you can advise those people to quarantine themselves and hopefully stop the spread of the virus further. a lot of the governments who are using location data, particularly location data from cell phones to do this, are doing it by assembling a massive database of the movements of every person, sick or healthy. South Korea and China have been especially aggressive on this front. With South Korea in particular collecting data not just from cell phones, but also from citizens' credit cards, GPS systems, and GPS systems to determine their locations and their interactions with others. The other purpose for which countries are using location data is to enforce social distancing or quarantine requirements. So rather than trying to prevent the spread of the virus by identifying who has come in contact with somebody who has the virus, these countries are using it to identify when somebody has, for example, left their house when the house is under quarantine. South Korea in particular has mandated that quarantined individuals download an app that tracks their location, enabling the government to detect when they break their quarantine restrictions. Governments in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Russia are also using smartphone apps, geofencing, and facial recognition technology to enforce quarantine restrictions on individuals. So obviously, these types of government restrictions raise some privacy concerns. When governments use tools like this, they do so at the cost of their citizens' privacy. And this trade-off is not that surprising. Because information about people is useful for many purposes, there's many trade-offs between privacy and other values. And we see this in a wide range of areas, but COVID-19 is sort of the latest example. And I think one of the most interesting things about this debate is how it's revealed that the idea that privacy is an absolute value that trumps all other values sort of falls apart when you're faced with something that looks quite threatening to the health and safety of many people. But obviously there really are concerns here, and the clash here is pretty dramatic. We do know, however, that calibrating the trade-offs that we might make between privacy and other values can be very difficult to do in advance. In fact, there's some evidence that existing U.S. privacy laws hindered the use of valuable medical information that slowed the initial response to the virus here. Specifically, university researchers in Washington State were delayed by weeks in their efforts to repurpose already gathered patient data to study the growing COVID-19 pandemic because of restrictions on how data about health medical patients can be used. So this is one reason that laws that restrict private sector use of data should allow beneficial uses, including using data to improve health and save lives. So, you know, I think my main message here would be that we've seen a lot of examples of other countries trying to use technology to fight COVID-19, and technology really can be a major contributor to this. It does seem like this information is a very powerful tool. But here in the U.S., we really do need to strike something that is consistent. We need to strike a balance that's consistent with our values. I mean, even when fighting real tangible harms like death and disease, unwarranted government surveillance without due process, it threatens our liberty. And our Constitution and our values limit what government can do, even when they're pursuing important goals. And so these privacy-protecting institutions are our country's, to use a kind of hackneyed metaphor, kind of our country's antibodies against government overreach and abuse. And so as we continue to talk about this today, I hope we'll talk about how the U.S. can strike the right balance between privacy and public health in looking at tools of technology in order to fight COVID-19. So those are kind of my three key points. I would love to turn it over now to Roger.
Thank you, Neil. And that was really a great introduction. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the constitutional issues and concerns first, to which you alluded, with respect primarily to contact tracing. I hadn't really thought too much about monitoring people who are under quarantine or isolation, which would raise even more serious concerns in many ways. And I think the discussion and framework would be similar for these. So first off, consider the Fourth Amendment, which states which protects the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. This shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause. So the Fourth Amendment primarily exclusively addresses searches and seizures in an investigatory context, which would apply to the quarantine or isolation setting. Privacy issues are often seen as reflecting the need for warrants and proper process when considering Fourth Amendment as opposed to purely substantive grounds, which bear on the appropriateness of process. Historically, the Fourth Amendment was primarily viewed in physical terms, but recent Supreme Court decisions take a broader view, especially in light of modern technologies that have much greater reach and potential for abuse. In the 2018 case of Carpenter versus the United States, the court, in considering the government's right to obtain cell site location information from the petitioner's cell phone, emphasized his expectation of privacy and the amendment's, quote, basic purpose, quote, to safeguard the privacy and security of individuals against arbitrary invasions by government officials. So we have fundamentally an underlying the Fourth Amendment, albeit mostly in an investigatory or criminal context, the right to safeguard the citizenry against arbitrary exertions of power by government officials. We move to the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, the due process arguments about which Neil mentioned in his introduction. And these ensure that no individual is deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And although these amendments are drafted in procedural terms, it includes, irrespective of one's views on the extent, by virtue of the analysis, includes a substantive basis for limitations on governmental power, because proper procedures imply outcomes that are neither arbitrary, capricious, nor unreasonable. So you have these constitutional provisions that protect individual liberties and individual rights, but these must be viewed together with what are acknowledged governmental rights to address emergent public health issues. So on the federal, from the federal end, you have the Commerce Clause, which does give authority to respond to emergencies to the federal government. It provides the basis for the Public Health Services Act, and that gives the HHS Secretary the right to regulate during health emergencies. And then states can exercise their rights to protect public health under police powers, which were acknowledged at least as early as the 1824 case of Gibbons versus Ogden, and rely on the 10th Amendment, which reserves to the states the powers not constitutionally delegated to the federal government nor prohibited by the Constitution to those states. So with respect to Fourth Amendment issues, as said, while violations of regulations and orders could result in criminal conduct, so we could talk about the monitoring of people who are violating quarantine or isolation. The context here in terms of contact tracing, which is really, I think, a larger subject of discussion at least in the lay press, we're not talking about criminal investigation. Instead, it's really we're discussing the prospective right of state and federal governments to monitor individuals' movements, associations, and behavior for the purposes of public health by taking steps to contain an infectious outbreak. And so hence we have these coexisting, potentially conflicting rights and considerations must be reconciled almost certainly on a fact-specific basis. And so I will give you my view, which may be a contrarian one, but as I look at it, in my view, mandatory tracing, mandatory contact tracing would not pass constitutional muster. The equities fall against it because it is, again, this is my view, it is mandatory contact tracing would be unnecessary, unjustified, and therefore unreasonable for a disease that for most affected individuals is mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic and kills only 1 to 4 out of 1,000 people, most of whom are sick and elderly. And it is this population on whom our attention should be focused and for whom governmentally imposed protective measures should be narrowly tailored. The idea of monitoring people who are under quarantine or isolation and through electronic surveillance seems even more draconian. This disease is contagious, but to an extent similar to influenza. So given the high proportion of mild and asymptomatic cases, there's no reason to believe intrusive monitoring measures through extreme levels of surveillance will be successful in eradicating this disease any more than they would be successful in eliminating the flu. Nor will they save more or even as many lives as direct attention to the protection of those at highest risk would. Rather, compelled contact tracing would result in severe and, through precedent, possibly permanent abridgment of individual freedom and rights to privacy that cannot be justified on empirical, medical, or scientific grounds. This is reinforced by recent instructions reportedly given by New York City's mayor that prohibit individuals performing contact tracing in the city from inquiring whether an infected individual attended mass gatherings called protests, where she or he may have acquired the infection or transmitted it to others. So instead of contact tracing, mandatory contact tracing, we should medicalize COVID-19 and voluntarily test those in whom the disease is suspected or those in whom there may be a risk of infection, especially when that infection risk presents a significant risk of adverse consequences for close associations, for example, elderly residents or ill spouses. And this would be done preferably upon visits to these individuals who choose to upon visits to these individuals' physicians for those who choose to take medical action to address this disease. That being said, and in recognition of differing well-informed opinion, I personally don't have a problem with voluntary contact tracing. That being said, I think regulation, it's sort of the flip side now, I think over-regulation could potentially cause a problem in this area and generally can be a problem in responding to emergent situations. So regulations that may be perceived to be cost of doing business, or that are passed along to consumers, or are mere annoyances, or even governmentally conferred competitive advantages, can become very disruptive when there are needs for rapid responses during public health emergencies. Altering the regulatory environment to allow for optimal responses and to have people willing to respond to meet current crises while protecting the public from harm from those who would capitalize on those crises presents unique and difficult challenges. It requires considerable agility with flexibility to alter responses to meet rapid changes in circumstances. And this, of course, is the opposite of the manner in which regulators and governments typically proceed. Unfortunately, there are no easy answers. An iterative approach is almost certainly required, but this suggests a high-level overview of the risks with conscious efforts to avoid the weeds in which regulators are normally immersed and rollbacks of the many regulations or requirements intended to protect against what are objectively non-critical or uncertain harms, but with which compliance can produce costly delays. Regulators should have the courage to move forward with the knowledge that such regulations can always be re-implemented. In the end, it is a risk balance calculation, but one that must be performed and acted upon within a radically shortened time frame with much less information than that with which regulators are accustomed to working. And just thinking about privacy rules in the context of contact tracing for COVID-19, regulations could present risk to some participants in the contact tracing enterprise, largely because of our convoluted healthcare privacy laws, which have onerous and at times impractical requirements, and which can mandate the imposition of substantial penalties. Therefore, overregulation could serve as an obstacle to proper conduct of contact tracing activities. In recognition of these, of this possibility generally, and then I'll stop. In recognition of the potential impediments, the privacy provisions of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, which we all know as HIPAA, posed to providers' ability to meet the exigencies of the COVID-19 epidemic, the administration announced policies of enforcement discretion for several elements, including prescriptive communication technology that's been required. They're using enforcement discretion for these regulations for telehealth providers who have been vital in performing services that don't involve physical contacts. They have used enforcement discretion to forswear penalties for community-based test sites that act responsibly, with the idea that we need to encourage this activity, that we wanted to expand testing and make more testing available, and therefore we wanted to make it easier on providers to do so and have greater willingness. And also this reflected an understanding of the tumultuous situation in which some of the testing would occur, drive-through sites, et cetera, where it could be very difficult to shield patient information. And then the administration or HHS through enforcement discretion, reducing maximum civil monetary penalties. And then HHS issued guidance of how covered entities can disclose health information or protected health information, PHI, to law enforcement and first responders for public health and health oversight activities. So the administration is certainly understands the dangers regulation can pose in developing a rapid and appropriate response to an emergent situation such as an epidemic, and has taken considered and measured responses to help those who are responsible for responding at the ground level do so in a way that encourages participation and allows freedom to respond, but yet attempts to preserve some degree of protection against people who would either willfully act in a neglectful way or intentionally do so. So with that, I'll close and go. Pass it on to Drew. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Roger. I think that was a really great overview of some of the key constitutional issues as well as the practical impacts of regulation in this space. perhaps surprising impacts for some. Drew, would love to hear from you.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. Yeah, I think a lot of the issues discussed, even from a constitutional and legal perspective, at least shed light on one of the core values that's important from a cybersecurity perspective in users that will be using contact tracing apps. And that's that all of these apps and their success or whatnot are predicated upon users being able to trust these apps and trust either that, you know, the data collected is being used for a legitimate purpose, or that they're being used, of course, you know, by entities that should be the ones using the data. But the other key aspect of that is, of course, how the data is being protected. And so the way that this has played out over the last 3 months is that there is not a homogeneous concept of what tracing looks like. Instead, there are a couple different models as it relates to which types of data are being collected from a technological standpoint with regard to contact tracing apps. And there's also even a divide amongst how these apps and how the developers are storing the data. And I know that was alluded to at the beginning of this discussion between the centralized models and the decentralized models. And those really play a big part in what the security risks are when it comes to what the likelihood and even the impact of a potential data breach would be, and also how to think about protecting that data or even, you know, choosing the right sort of app from a cybersecurity perspective. And so, you know, for a lot of these apps, they're really relying upon, you know, Bluetooth pings mostly, but some apps actually go, you know, a bit more aggressively and have not only Bluetooth data, but also have GPS data and can even be matched to a user's profile with personal information. And so you really have the full spectrum there. And a lot of countries around the world have, you know, been looking at either developing their own apps or using frameworks like the Apple and Google framework and whatnot. And these are the sorts of debates that have played out across the globe, and they're playing out here in the States, even as we see states adopt different models, where some are opting to use apps that are more privacy-centric in terms of collecting a lot less intrusive data, and others that might be more impactful and useful perhaps for some of the public health measures, but that include a lot more data, so that if you're thinking about, you know, what could happen in the event of a data breach, then you're thinking about data being more ready to use and misuse for purposes that some sort of adversary may have. And so for the apps that are relying upon, you know, Bluetooth only and that are storing data in a decentralized manner, a lot of the cybersecurity risk is associated with Bluetooth itself rather than the data, you know, being any different than what so many people already are providing to so many different companies by virtue of having a multitude of apps already installed on their phones. And so for some of these contact tracing apps, they're actually a lot less intrusive than, say, social media apps that are installed on many people's devices in terms of what sort of data there is that needs to be protected from a cybersecurity standpoint. But nonetheless, having Bluetooth on all the time, which is necessary for many of these apps to work so that you're having these pings go on, that in and of itself can pose a security risk, even though for some of the potential attack vectors, you're really looking at a security risk from those who would have to have some sort of device or they themselves be physically close to you versus a remote attack. But nonetheless, you're still dealing there with something that people might have Bluetooth on and pinging regularly anyway because of some of the other apps they use. But that's something that's very important to consider. And then there's, on the other end of the spectrum, as I was mentioning, there are these apps that also are incorporating GPS data and are doing full-scale location tracking. And so there you can imagine that when you have data like that and you're mapping out the patterns that people are following every day in their daily routines, then you have data that would be a lot more sensitive if you were faced with a data breach. And so you could have a situation in which even the way the data stored might not be PHI, because perhaps you certainly have some models where it's much harder by the raw data to discern if someone is an infected person or not. So you could have some data hacked off of somebody's device, and yet that could still be telling, of course, of location data, which is going to be sensitive for other purposes. But where there's a lot of cybersecurity risk that seems to be identified even by public health authorities that are switching models or considering other models is around these systems that have a centralized repository of all the data. Because there, even when you're using terrific privacy by design principles and having unique identifiers that aren't revealing in and of themselves of individuals, to the extent that they're reversible and to the extent that they're being matched with an indicator that somebody has been infected or self-reported that they were infected, then that's where you could potentially, depending on what data an adversary is accessing, that's where you could potentially have a pool of data that could be reversible and that could be revealing of PHI while simultaneously being revealing of device identifiers, which can be valuable data for other purposes too. And so that's where, for those that are using centralized models, it's really important that they're thinking about security holistically and thinking about, deploying whatever the best practices that they should be thinking about anyway for their whole organization, deploying those specifically and especially for whichever servers they're using to store data. And so that, of course, includes, not only thinking about how you're encrypting communications going back and forth, but even thinking about whether or not you have endpoint security software installed that's actually monitoring whether or not you have potential adversary behavior and someone that's on there that shouldn't be on there. And so that's really important. Whereas with these decentralized apps, there's a lot less cybersecurity responsibility placed on the organizations that are running these systems or the developers, in the case that it's the developers getting data. But nonetheless, that's where still, again, I go back to that issue of trust, where it's really important that you are designing for security where you have the notion of your user in mind and whether or not they can trust your app. Because already what we've observed in the past 3 months related to COVID is that you have entire adversary campaigns focused on using COVID-19 as a theme in order to harvest credentials, just even using traditional email phishing campaigns or using malware campaigns, malicious spam campaigns. And so, you're likely going to see more of this with regard to apps themselves. We've already seen instances where cyber criminals have created fake apps that are intended to spoof legitimate apps. So that way a user would download the fake app, which would be harvesting then a lot more information. And so a lot of what is important to consider from a cybersecurity standpoint is actually that holistic awareness and education of everyone, that just because, an app purports to be the health app that you think you want to use you have an interest in making sure that you're enrolled in some sort of contact tracing program, that does not mean that is the app. And that's where there really need to be aggressive efforts to make sure that app developers, as well as those running these app stores, are helping to root out any sort of supply chain attacks in addition to spoofed apps, because you can even have legitimate apps being on a store and an adversary is able to, replace the legitimate app with a fake one by hacking the developer that was placing the app on there, because we've seen supply chain apps, for example, for years in other fields. And so all of that is really important to consider, whereas I think a lot of the discussion often focuses on just the data itself by these apps, but because of the diversity of models out there, not all of these apps are going to be as sensitive as others with regard to the data. And yet the whole notion of moving people to go and trust an app, start putting some sort of indicator as to whether or not they're infected in an app, that's what makes all these other components of cybersecurity really, really important, especially during this time where we see all these concerted efforts. And similarly, for organizations that are looking as into whether or not they're going to use apps as some sort of confidence-building measure to get people back into offices in person, that's something else where there's different models even there geared at organizations, where I've seen models where instead of, following some of these broader frameworks like the Google Apple one, they actually try to be more narrow by only collecting even the Bluetooth ping information within a specific geolocation. So meaning they're looking at whether or not there are close contacts within an office, which, is something that, would only be presumably used by an employer and looking at, if one of their employees became infected, who else was in close contact with that employee, especially if you're dealing with multiple floors in an office or whatnot. And so some of those are designed where they're all query-based, where there's nothing in any sort of server storing any information about whether or not someone was infected, and you're just launching a query based on a unique identifier when your employee decides that they're going to inform you of that. But even with something there, similarly, that's something where then you're going to have your employees perhaps having their Bluetooth radios on all the time at their phone, and so you have to be thoughtful about whether or not there's other security risks inherent in that, particularly depending on, where the office space is, how much control you have over even the physical security of that space and whatnot. And so that's something where, I think some of these issues and some of the things to think about are no different than looking at any other apps. And the use case itself is, of course, novel, but a lot of the security considerations are very, very similar with a lot of these apps that are focused more so on the Bluetooth pings rather than on full location data. And then the ones with full location data and then keeping a record of whether or not someone's infected, that's where it's very important to pay attention to the data retention policies of those sorts of apps, because that can help address, what the risk really looks like. If data is rolling off after 14 days, like many of these, then in the case of a breach, it could still be bad, still have an impact on people, but it might not, be as bad as if there's another one where they're just keeping a database because they're going to use it for other statistical purposes and whatnot and have this data forever. So that's another thing to look at. With that, I think there's already a lot of incentives in a lot of data protection laws that have popped up over the past few years for app developers, as well as for organizations that might be deploying these apps, to really have an incentive to protect this data, to consider cybersecurity by law, such as HIPAA, CCPA, GDPR, and others. But nonetheless, the devil's in the details with this.
Thanks so much, Drew. That was great. I think you made it pretty clear how complicated the cybersecurity implications of all of this are. It did spark a question, and I know I want to get to the audience Q&A, but it did spark a question in my mind that I'd like to flip back to Roger. Drew, you talked a lot about these wide variety of models that raise really different levels of cybersecurity risk, everything from a centralized database that collects very sensitive detailed data about health conditions and detailed location data, to something that maybe raises fewer risks, which would be like a decentralized on the phone collection of some smaller set of perhaps less sensitive data. And I was wondering, Roger, how does that change in risk of a data security breach? How might that impact the constitutional analysis of a mandatory contact tracing app installation? Would it change your answer if it was a very limited collection of data in a distributed manner? Or do you think that it doesn't have a big impact on the final answer, even if it would be a factor in the analysis?
Well, I think so. From my end, the problem with mandatory contact tracing, or as you suggested, sort of a house arrest situation for a monitored house arrest situation for an infected person or a person who's been exposed. The problem, in my view, would be this tracking. You know, this detailed tracking of a person's movement, contacts, activities, tracking of these things through electronic means or surveillance, where the person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. So, I mean, there's two aspects to this. There's the expectation of privacy, and then there's the part about, let's say you're using cell phone data and you're turning it over to a third party, and do you still have a reasonable expectation of privacy? And historically you did not, but or at least in many contexts you did not, financial information, for example. But in Carpenter, the petitioner was found to have a reasonable expectation of privacy because of the pervasive use of cell phones. It was cell phone tracking that was done, and essentially the inability to get by without one, and the notion that you really didn't have a choice but to send signals to these towers, and so there would be an expectation of privacy on the part of the user. And I think that's still the fundamental choice with imposed data collection is whether or not one is infringing on the expectation of privacy that one normally has, whether or not there's a substantive right to it. I think it depends on the circumstances. So what I would say with respect to COVID-19 is, if you have very mild restrictions or regulations that meet what, in my view, is a severe disease for some people, for most not, and largely something that is unlikely to be eliminated through any of these means whatsoever. It would have to be mild, because in my view the situation that we're facing with COVID is less severe. If this were Ebola, for example, and people, you know, a high proportion of people who got the disease died, if it was extraordinarily contagious, where basically if you went near somebody, anybody who went near somebody got it, you know, like measles, for example, where the whole room gets infected, I might look at it differently, but on a fact-specific basis, and I think we need to look at both aspects on a fact-specific basis, I think that any restrictions that were mandated would need to be very minimal, because I don't think that the threat warrants, and this is my view, I don't think that the threat is extreme enough to warrant the deprivation or abridgment or abrogation of civil liberties in the name of protecting the public.
Great. Drew, can I flip a question back to you? I am curious about this, how from a cybersecurity perspective you might think about the difference between a mandated installation of an app versus a voluntary installation maybe of an array of different apps. What would be the sort of ways that you might think of that, those different regimes from a cybersecurity perspective?
Sure, yeah. From a cybersecurity perspective, it's really going to come down to, you know, which model. So if you're, mandating one of these models that are certainly less popular. I mean, to be clear, I think the trend we're now seeing, even at some states and countries switch apps midstream, is that people are gravitating toward these decentralized models that are also less intrusive in terms of how much data is being collected. But just starting with the models that collect a lot more data, where you actually have what would even be regulated personal information as well as regulated PHI just on its face without even having to pivot to re-identify, I think then you're basically creating a cybersecurity scenario where you're, forcing a user to have that protected data that should be protected even by law for cybersecurity purposes with, you know, on some other server. And so there what you're creating is certainly an expectation that then that data that's going to be regulated data for PII as well as PHI is going to be protected with the best practices that should be used right now, especially as healthcare providers are being attacked with ransomware and everything else. And so that's where you're going to want to be using protection that can protect against all of that. And if that's not the case from a cybersecurity perspective, then that's something where, you know, I think there's really an inherent problem with that. Whereas, you know, if it's mandatory and it's a decentralized model, I think then you're shifting a lot of the cybersecurity risk to the holder of the device, of the phone. And so if it's an organization doing this and they're able to deploy some sort of cybersecurity solution to mobile devices, then it might be something where you would want that going hand in hand as part of any sort of program with that. If it's mandatory from a government, then you're not going to have that sort of thing. And so what you're going to have to worry about there then is that users are completely vigilant and aware of what a legitimate version of the app looks like and what's not legitimate, as well as even ignoring and worrying about some of the phishing attempts we've seen with SMS. There's already been a lot where, and this is, has gone on not only in the U.S. but throughout the globe, where there are SMS messages focused on COVID-19 that are targeting users pretending to be either a health authority or an app or whatnot. And I think that if you have an area where you would have users that are mandated to be enrolled in some sort of app program, it might be that the app data itself, if we're just talking about the Bluetooth pings stored on device, you know, it might be that there's not a huge risk of a data breach from any sort of centralized source, but instead it's really the social engineering opportunity that that would create. And that would be my primary concern, actually, more than the data in that situation where you're talking about the apps that don't collect full location data. Then that's something I'd still really, really worry about because we're already seeing it.
That's very helpful. Thank you. I'd love to open it up to Q&A, Colton, if we could, from the audience.
While we wait for our first question, Neil, I'd like to turn it back to you for any other remarks.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking, actually, when you were comparing the risks from a centralized database and the breach there, particularly one under government control, you know, immediately made me think of the OPM database, which people didn't really have an option to be in or not, and which had quite sensitive data and was obviously a centralized location, and some of the risks there. You know, the observation around the risks of the distributed ones where you have a bunch of different competing apps and it can be tough for the user to perhaps identify a legitimate app in that group, you know, that's a whole other set of issues. Lots of complicated issues here. I'd love to, if we don't have a question, I'd love to turn it back to you guys to see if there's anything each of you said that you want to respond to. I haven't given you much time to respond to each other.
We actually have our first question, and I think we'll go to that now, right, considering we have 10 minutes left.
Thank you, gentlemen, for this presentation. I'm calling out of Virginia, and I've already had to experience going to a restaurant, having to give information that I don't think I should have to give to simply sit down and eat a meal. And I apologize if the question is already answered because, unfortunately, I missed the first few minutes of the presentation. But it seems to me there's just an assumption that we have to accept that we're going to have to be doing this for the public health. And I find it very disturbing as someone who is in, because of medical reasons, I'm dealing with doctors a lot in the last few years. It is not comfortable to have to be questioned in every movement of your day tracked, which is what this is looking towards in some of the training coming out of Johns Hopkins. So are we just assuming that this is the way forward and anything in the name of public health now can, you know, get the camel's nose under the tent and they're going to surveil so that even when it's flu season, we're going to have the great benefactor of the government telling us, okay, everybody, it's time to don your mask. It's flu season. So I'm asking, are we assuming a couple of things here, or is there still any kind of privacy for medical information? And that's it. Thank you, gentlemen.
Great question. I have some thoughts, but I'd like to open it to Roger and Drew since I've been talking lately.
Yeah, okay. I think that the caller has mentioned has great concerns, and I think she's spot on with them. She mentioned a restaurant. So what I would say, if a private business wants to ask questions, there are certain laws and regulations about health information that prohibit businesses from inquiring. Many of these are more geared toward discrimination in health services. But I think if they're reasonable, if a business, for example, wants to have some level of protection, for example, for its customers or its workers, I think that it can be justified. And again, this is a private actor, and what I was mostly speaking to were actions that the government would compel. And so I think it's different in the private sphere. But the problem is, and I think you're touching on something, that the more we get used to and accustomed to sacrificing our privacy, our freedom, and our liberty under the guise of an emergency, the more likely and willing we are to do it in the future. And I think it presents a profound risk to the individual freedom that we all enjoy. The other point I would make, and this has to do with health privacy generally, is that the way our health privacy laws work, they apply to covered entities, which are really a group of healthcare providers and business associates as well of these providers who take electronic payments for providing healthcare services. And so the HIPAA law, which is the major health privacy law, really doesn't apply in a lot of contexts if people aren't or if an entity isn't taking payment by electronic means for health services. And there may be other means by which one could reach civil means, particularly whereby one may be able to obtain redress, but it's not as clear, I think, in many contexts. And so I think that the concerns that you have anyway, I think are great and legitimate. We all need to be asking these questions.
This is Drew, and I'll just respond from a cybersecurity standpoint. With that is, I would just say kind of similar to my thoughts on the app. Anytime you're in a situation where you're providing more data to different entities, then there's obviously going to be inherent cybersecurity risks for keeping that data safe. But I don't know that any of that is even any different in many ways than what we're already facing now from a cybersecurity standpoint, where for all of us to do basic interactions with shopping or anything else, we obviously have our personal data going all over. There's certain types of even Bluetooth beacons deployed in shopping malls and whatnot, and so you really already have a lot of that going on, and we've already seen over the years with various breaches what that looks like on the back end when data isn't protected to begin with. So to the extent we're now going to be facing that in any sort of different way or with even new types of data, I think the cybersecurity concerns themselves would still be the same, where whether you're a small business or you're a large enterprise, you're responsible for information and you need to protect that information. And you can't, especially in modern times, throw up your arms and say, oh, well, we weren't a tech company, so we didn't think we had to worry about information, because instead there really is this responsibility now held by virtually everyone.
Cool. And do we have another question?
We don't, but we are approaching the top of the hour. Okay. So Neil, Drew, Roger, do you have any final thoughts for our audience?
I think I would just, for my final thoughts, I would key off the questioner's great points. Our cultural adjustments to the use of data about us, I mean, data has huge potential. It's very useful. I think it's created a lot of the benefits, including a lot of the benefits that have allowed many people to continue working during social distancing and quarantining in the U.S. But obviously, it has a lot of concerns as well. And I think the questioner raised some really valid points about what happens if we get used to handing out all sorts of sensitive information to people that we weren't doing that before. I think there's one level of concerns, including constitutional concerns, when the person collecting that information is the government, because in many ways the risk is quite different there, especially if it's used or repurposed for law enforcement. But there are risks in other situations, as Drew has mentioned. So I'll just leave off there. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I think this is a great discussion, and there's so much here and so much to get our arms around. My presentation and my comments were largely directed toward government mandated action, and in looking at, first of all, in voluntary interactions with private actors, such as somebody who's providing an app and the idea or creating a database and the idea that we could either voluntarily or in an exclusively private way improve health, for example, in a workplace or in other commercial settings, venues, entertainment venues, for example. I think there's utility, potential utility in it, and as suggested, they're obviously doing a lot of work with cybersecurity, an area in which I have limited knowledge or expertise. I think people just have to weigh the benefits versus the risks to doing it. I mean, I tend to be somewhat cautious in sacrificing information and rights because I'm unconvinced that the combination of its severity and our willingness and our ability really to do anything in the end to eliminate it strike the balance against doing so. But I think these are very important issues with respect to private transmission of data, and companies can do a lot of things with data, and I think it can be difficult to obtain recourse in some circumstances after one has relinquished data and once out of the bottle, it's hard to put the genie back in, and people are gathering all kinds of data on us. It's amazing what and Drew can tell you one piece of information here, one piece of information there, and these computers are so smart, they go and they link everything together, and then, maybe something gets out that you don't want it to. So I just think we need to be thinking about that, the risks and concerns and considerations.
Drew, you want to take the last word?
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the discussion here today. I think that when thinking about whether it's the COVID-19 tracing apps or thinking about even some of these other concerns like the ones posed by the questioner about what other similar types of data we could be asked to give in different social contexts, it's really important just to draw lessons from a cybersecurity perspective on the world we already know and the world we've already seen, because the attacks are essentially the same, but it's just, a new theme. And so what we've already observed the past few months at CrowdStrike is that the healthcare industry is obviously being targeted. Government agencies responsible for public health are being targeted. But then also users are regularly being targeted with these sorts of themes. And that's going to continue. And so in this sea of noise, especially if there are lots of different types of tracing apps and whatnot, that's where it's really important, not only for, you know, these apps to be designed with security in mind and with privacy in mind, but it's really important, again, for the entire ecosystem to recognize their responsibilities with cybersecurity to ensure that, you know, that they really are taking this seriously, because a data breach with a COVID-19 related app, you know, lots of these apps are voluntary and it's not really a lot of data. But the thing here is any sort of data breach can be helpful for matching data to other data from other data breaches. And so that's where you really get into a situation where if the cybersecurity messaging and the cybersecurity efforts are only rallying around, you know, one perceived new type of technology, then you forget how important all the rest is. And so that's where I think it's just really important that, you know, anytime we're implementing technology, we're considering not only the design of the technology, but how you're actually protecting users and keeping users safe at the end of the day, you know, both on the remote end where you're storing their data, but even with their devices and ensuring, again, that they can have that trust in using that device because there is some sense of cybersecurity.
All right. To Neil, Roger, Drew, and to our live audience, we are very grateful to you all for your time today. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us. This concludes today's call.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.